I said, what you know about it?
It's the stew, baby.
Got the mise en place.
Young stew, baby.
And the room a lot.
Hello, hello. We're listening to The Stew. My name is Jason Stewart. This is my food podcast, What Is Good. We have four people today. The beers are cracking.
We got a guest.
Andre Canaparo is in the building. Stewie is in the building.
Hello, everybody.
Okay, we're just getting these mic levels. Terrence Tay, our old friend, is in the house. Say hello, Terrence.
What's good?
A little bit. Let's get a little bit more volume on that voice, Governor.
What's good?
I'm going to project.
You got to project. You're in the biz, man. You know how it goes.
And I haven't got headshots yet.
For our listeners at home, he is British.
That's right.
British and Asian.
It's that special.
Great combo.
Is this our first British guest?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you for crossing that for us.
Like are on this year.
Just luminaries of the food world.
I don't know if they have this phrase in London, but a real who's who of the culinary world. The Batalis of the world, the Bourdains, the list goes on.
The Changs.
Chris Chang, yeah. Chris Chang has been on.
Yeah. Not David Chang.
Yeah, the Chang gang.
No.
We got,
and there's no Bronsons. Brothers. No Huangs.
Yet.
Yeah, somehow, yeah.
I don't think we're ever going to have Eddie Wong on this podcast.
Yeah. But
no, yeah. this is real.
Yeah, this is more real. This is the food podcast your grandmother warned you about.
This is the MS-13 of food podcasts, and everybody knows it.
Very gangster.
So, Terrence, we've known you for a long time. You're also floating around in the food world. You've helped write a cookbook.
Yes,
you've done some pop-ups. You've worked on some websites and editorial food contents, and you've cooked yourself.
Some pilots.
Some what?
Some pilots.
Some pilots. What kind of pilots?
The Don't Say Fried Chicken pilot.
The
short-lived pilot.
How'd that pilot work out for you?
Not that well.
Still kicking around?
Still there.
What were you hoping to have this pilot consist of?
We actually shot it. Okay, this kind of shows what kind of timeline this was. Rusko was a guest on the pilot.
No way. That's awesome.
Dubstep producer Rusko was a guest?
Maluka, and not the new Maluka Mala, but the old Maluka.
Mm-hmm.
The fiery Maluka.
What year was this?
Fuego Maluka.
So far, this has nothing to do with food.
We were cooking. It was with the Dante, Dante vibes.
Okay.
I don't know, maybe 2011, 12, 2011? Mm-hmm. No, maybe actually earlier. No, 2010, 2011. Because basically we got the pilot, we didn't get it anywhere, but we got hooked.
Lenny Troutman is also on the podcast. Yeah.
It's feeling though.
Okay.
we got a cookbook deal from it though.
Oh, that's perfect.
So that's how we got that.
I think that's plenty to be thankful for.
What consisted of a 2010 food hipster indie music food pilot?
So what tied into it, which was pretty funny.
Some singers over and then we're like, we're going to make fried chicken?
That was dinner with the band. Although the same guy, Kaleem Armstrong, who's a very dear friend and pretty amazing filmmaker now, he actually was the director on both pilots. Dinner with the band got picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Say Fried Chicken did not. But ours was a little bit different. So it was like kind of cooking around the world, cooking with guests, and then it was part travel show, part food.
Mm-hmm.
We shot the pilot in London, all around West London, around Carnival.
Mm-hmm. There's so many food and travel shows now. I'm dying for something else. I can't stand watching another person go to another place that people have been to on every other show.
Yeah.
It's just so rough.
I mean, everyone has to have their own take, you know, cause especially LA. LA is gigantic. So you could do a million episodes on LA. Lenny agrees with me. San Francisco alone, yeah, it's endless. So, I mean, I agree and disagree because you're getting other people's perspectives.
Yeah, but they all go to the same places.
Well, that's, yeah, and that, I mean, that's kind of the, that's the hard thing, is to try and figure out what exactly, what's new, what's interesting, where, what hasn't been completely shot out.
Yeah, and what you want to watch.
Yes.
I think more, like, that's the main thing that a lot of people, I think, forget about. Just the idea, if you're making a show, it's for people to watch it.
I mean, if it's good, you know, I guess it's just, the whole point is just make it good.
Yeah, but it's not good.
Exactly.
We need something better.
Well, it's also, I mean, you're inherently kind of putting yourself slightly at a disservice when you're building a show, or at least with the travel food shows, when travel is such a big part of your show, it eats so much of your budget. If you're not already on a network, if you're not, you know, it's like you're already making the choice to be like, this is not going to be cheap or easy logistically.
Yeah.
And you're also, I mean, unless you have that Bourdain money, it's like you can't really spend the time you would want to in a place covering it as well as you'd want to once you do all the work to get people there. It's hard. It's definitely towing a line, but then at the same time, it's also very exciting in the same way. I mean, I would love to see an 8-part show on food in Detroit, food in Pittsburgh, where you literally just cover like 6 restaurants a show. And that's, I mean, I don't hang my hat on Guy Fieri, but I still think, I ride for this, that Diners, Drives, and Dives is a better show than a lot of food shows in the way that it's engaging. He's frustrating to look at, but where he goes and what he covers is something that kind of is glossed over in a lot of other food shows.
Mm-hmm. He's okay with not finding a cool hipster place that's different and unique.
If you have a great pancake, he's going to show up, and that's kind of like...
It does have to be a funky little joint, though.
It does.
And they got to have parking.
They got to have a triple D's.
But it's... But I have, and I've said this before, I've walked into places, you know, Oinkster, but I've walked into places that I wanted to eat at, and suddenly there's a Guy Fieri poster on the wall, and it's like, Triple D was shot here, and you're just like, God damn it. But then you eat, and it's like, this is actually really good. Mm-hmm. It's food for everyone, and I think there's not enough mix of that sometimes in destination food shows. They're showing you a lot of things that people, for the most part, it can't be a daily driver.
Like the whole polar opposite would be Chef's Table.
100%. But I think there's absolutely a place for that show. And that show is, I think, the pinnacle of quality and
if you're really
cinematography
into slow
of that.
Wide shots.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's like, I think too many things are trying to be that. Or you get food competition shows, which are my least favorite, because I really like to separate food from competition, because it's the last thing that draws me to food is somehow something's better, as opposed to it's all great and why.
I still ride for Top Chef, though, even though it's kind of total garbage right now.
I used to be a big Top Chef fan, but now it has become garbage. Where it used to be like a straight up competition show, like make the best blank, and then they just do it, and now it's like make the best blank while blindfolded in a shark tank underwater, and then if you don't cook the egg in time, they're going to dump slime on you.
And you can only use Tostino's pizza rolls.
Yeah, you have to incorporate Tostino's pizza rolls. That's why the only show I really fuck with is Iron Chef.
The main ingredient is dino nuggets. And you're like, what? Why would you do that? This is a dino nugget crusted piece of halibut. But yeah.
Yeah, it's never like, what's the best thing you can make? It's just like, what is like a thing that you may be able to make with these horrible circumstances.
A lot of broth as well. Always that packaged broth, right? Which you don't get in the UK. You don't get cartons of broth that look like UHT milk.
How does your broth
good or bad?
Come?
6-hour simmer.
You can't buy prepackaged liquid broth in
you can,
the UK?
You can, but it's not kind of as prevalent, I would say, in that it would
it's
be...
Very, it's much more frowned upon.
It wouldn't be the sponsor of a TV show.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But you guys are more of a bouillon cube culture as well, though.
100%.
I respect that.
Which is basically just that and water, huh?
Dried with some MSG.
Yeah, loads.
Some. How do you feel about MSG?
Nothing wrong with MSG.
You okay with it?
Yeah. Fuck with MSG.
Totally. Same.
I remember being a little kid and literally dipping my finger into what looks like the crystals of salt, and it literally turning my mouth inside out, though. That was weird.
turning your mouth inside out.
It's a bit intense.
Like, I haven't experienced. Okay, go.
Yeah, no, they had like, I just remember like kind of growing up, and even if we were cooking at home and say my father would make fried rice, it would always taste like restaurant fried rice. And you're like, what the fuck is that little thing? And then when I got old enough.
You're such a good chef. What is it?
I realized that he put this thing in. And so I remember literally just going, what does it actually taste like? And licking my finger, dipping it into this bag and putting it in my mouth. And it was crazy. But then the whole, that was more of a fun little thing, but I don't have anything.
But what did it actually taste like exactly? For those of us who have not just done a little...
A little bump of little, pure MSG.
Yeah, just done a little Molly hit of pure MSG.
It literally looks like kind of...
Ketamine?
Crystals. It looks like...
Ketamine, sorry.
A little K?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like...
Don't Google
little,
that, Mom.
Little crystals, but kind of long... Kind of nylon fibers.
Really? Oh,
wow. Yeah. So it looks like that.
I've seen it in bags at Asian groceries, but I've never actually kind of seen it like sitting in a bowl out. I just thought it looked like salt, but it's a little different.
No, it looks like literally kind of like little fibers of salt.
Mm-hmm. So interesting.
And it tasted like nothing. It didn't taste of anything. That's the thing that's really weird. It was like, it's literally that enhancer.
Exactly.
So by itself was just like a very strange sensation of literally turning your mouth inside out.
Well, I haven't experienced this that much, but I know people have traveled like in Asia, Southeast Asia. Like it's a condiment. Like it will be on a table and
but
it can
mixed
be in
with other stuff, I think, as a condiment rather than.
No. Well, or I've been told there's times where, because it can be powdered or it can be liquid. And it'll just be like literally a clear liquid on a table without like really anything.
Like
or
the Maggie.
Maybe mixed with a little bit of salt. But like
Maggie.
Yeah. You're just looking for the bomb.
You just put a couple squirts in there and toss it up.
Yep.
What kind of fried rice did Pops make? What was his go-to?
Super classic.
Yeah, give it up.
Yeah. Eggs, some shrimps, some little frozen peas in there.
Love frozen peas in the fried rice. The
smallest amount of soy sauce, so it still kept that kind of good look.
Didn't just
look
the color, like yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
to me, barbecued pork will always be the Cadillac of fried rice. To me, like barbecued pork is always like that's the go-to flavor I'm looking at in like a nice restaurant, American Chinese fried rice.
The thing that I'm always surprised by with the fried rice is you oftentimes you put like the egg in first, like the what?
Right.
100%.
The ingredient that takes the least amount of time to cook.
Yeah,
and has the highest potential of overcooking and becoming hard and bad. That's what you put into like a 1,000-degree wok first.
Yeah,
and then you cook all the other ingredients with it, but it still manages to become nice and moist and integrated.
I think it's the rice. I think it's
also if you're really trying to do a showpiece fried rice, like you're planning ahead and you know this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you want to make rice the day before and let it dry out in the fridge for texture.
Oh, right on.
And it's also like when I'm going to make a tortilla de riso, like when you cook rice with egg and you want a very specific firm texture, you're not going to get that without letting it kind of sit out and dry a little.
Oh,
The best is over, like if you fry rice and fry it really hard and actually fry it for a bit longer so it dries out even further and that's when it gets super tasty.
Yeah.
I've been house sitting and the morning, my first morning there, I woke up and there was a notice that the gas was turned off. Which is pretty sick, so I couldn't make coffee, which is a big bummer. And then I look up and I'm like, oh, that's a really nice rice cooker. So I made it for breakfast. Well, first I heated up water in the rice cooker to make my own coffee, which is like, I felt really proud of that.
Very good. You're definitely MacGyvering this morning situation quite a bit.
You boiled your water in a rice cooker.
Yeah, and I weighed it out probably. I put the rice cooker
just like
insert
the, like the founding
on
fathers
the scale.
Used to.
Yeah. And I really did it right. I was
that's
like
amazing.
Super. Like I'm gonna do this shit. I'm like, this is.
Is
gonna,
that because whose house you're at just doesn't have a kettle?
No, the gas is turned off.
The gas is turned off. No, he has
nothing.
Yeah.
Like
no electric kettle.
No electric kettle. Cold showers, by the way. And so I was like, I really want eggs.
Yeah, but thank God it's 95 degrees outside right now.
That's true. But
it's still a how's your father morning of when you're house sitting somebody.
I mean, it's definitely horrible.
I didn't see it coming. But
what I'm saying is, thank God it ain't February.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
February in Los Angeles.
Reminding me.
Hella cold.
Oh, it'll
God.
Hit. It'll
frigid.
Hit, sometimes it'll hit the low 60s.
Oh, God.
That's Fahrenheit, not Celsius.
Yeah.
Well, but I cooked my
get
rice.
Get that Montclair out.
You need that Canada goose on a
my leathers,
like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Stone Island.
But when I cooked my rice for breakfast, I threw sweet potato and onions in the rice while it's cooking, and it's like just kind of like steamed to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And
it just kind of steamed to perfection.
And mm-hmm. I just cracked a couple eggs inside and like folded a little mound on top of the eggs, and then I just like let it sit for a bit, and then swirled it up. You can obviously tell
sure
I had nothing else to do.
Are you sure this wasn't a Top Chef challenge where you had to cook an entire
meal? I was hungry, and I was hungry. This is the stuff I had just bought the day prior at the grocery store, so I was like, I'm not going to let this stuff go to waste.
At what point did you have to incorporate bacon and cheddar Hot Pockets into your breakfast to win the challenge?
Never. No, I'm a grown-up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Does he have a nice rice cooker, or is it just
a
regular?
It's a very nice rice cooker.
Fuzzy Logic?
Yeah. No. But, no, okay, pretty good.
And it has does it have the warming setting? Where
it's got a white rice, brown rice, warming, slow cook, steam, and, yeah.
Here's the thing.
And quick rice.
Does it have a kanji button?
No, that'd be
when
sick.
When you see the kanji button, you're just like, damn, where'd you get that at? Yeah,
that's Amazon.com.
Well,
that's the M3 enough, series.
Yeah, right?
I need to get one of those.
Definitely. You're flexing with the kanji button.
But I was proud.
You know what? You want a little kanji tip?
Yes.
Yes.
Please. Always.
Kanji tips.
This should be a little regular segment. So you know like when you go to dim sum spots and the kanji is like super white and really pure and really clean looking and a totally mm-hmm. different texture.
Like I like my friends. Yep. There you go.
Exactly. So what you got to do is when you wash the rice, wash it with salt. And like it kind of, whatever it does there, it kind of like starts to coarsen it out or breaks down or whatever it does. You mm-hmm. wash it with salt. You rinse it like normal so it's not salty water. Not salty water. And then mm-hmm. you do it. And what you cook out is super pure white. The rice breaks down. That's the time.
It's just like an agitator.
I've never heard this tip. And this sounds like it could be a game changer. So
it is.
Wash the rice with salt water instead of regular water.
Yeah, like literally chuck in some like coarse Morden or something while you're washing that.
The good?
That's a kanji
on a washing
flex,
salt?
Baby.
Yeah.
Woo. But that makes a lot of sense. I mean, not unlike when you're, like, if you're trying to make, like, a little garlic puree, where you'll chop the garlic and smash it down and sprinkle some salt on top, and you use that as kind of like a coarse mm-hmm. sandpaper to help kind of dissolve and break it down.
Just, like, I don't know why it keeps it so white, though. Like, there's something about it. But this was
scrub
from
off
like
a layer.
Yeah, it does something.
One of my all-time favorite cheap kitchen tools I've ever found, and I was probably Googling for a rice maker, but I found a Japanese rice washer on Amazon. And it's like, you've used it. It's like $8, but it's basically like a colander that's just built for washing rice. So the bottom is a really fine sieve, but on the top it's almost got like a pour spout with the same fine sieve. So you can wash the rice in it, also kind of like scrape it against the bottom of the colander, and then also pour the water out.
Like you're digging for gold.
Because it's really, I find to be like one of the easiest things to do is to skip washing rice, and it makes such a big difference, but it's such an annoying process. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's an annoying process, and it's a little wasteful with the water.
Oh, you get really, like, especially in Southern California, you're just like, mm-hmm. yeah. that's a lot of water.
Like, I'm going to make one cup of rice. I'm going to use 7 gallons.
Yep.
Yeah. And 10 minutes later.
It's like you're growing an almond or something.
It's like you're growing a damn almond. And then you haven't even actually added the water to cook the rice in.
And then think about working in a restaurant.
I didn't think about that. Oh, brother. They're all going to be like that now, man.
It's really
California.
Intense.
Like,
the water.
Yeah, what's it like
makes
being
you
across
very
the pond
sad.
Where the water flows like wine?
Like this chilled Beaujolais that we have.
This is a nice one.
But it's good.
Yeah.
What are we drinking here right now, Stewie?
I don't even know.
Italiano?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the lake. Shout out Silver Lake Wine.
It is nice, especially chilled.
Mm-hmm. He incepted me with the chilled wine.
Who?
You. Oh, Terrence did. Sorry. People can't tell that I'm pointing at Terrence. What's Sterna di Asti? Yeah.
That chilled red is one of my favorites in this heat.
Yeah, man. I agree.
Speaking though of Silver Lake Wine, I think Everson and Royce Bar on Sunday is having its 1-year anniversary.
Oh wow!
Free food.
Get out! Really?
Yeah, it's like 6 hours. They're doing free food and
oh, that'd
and wine
be so dead slow there
at Royce Bar.
Yeah,
I've heard it's good.
Not Royce Bar.
Everson Royce.
Everson and Royce. Royce Bar. Oh yeah, yeah.
They started, so it's Silver Lake Wine, Pastina's, Everson Royce, which is the big version of Silver Lake Wine, and then they open a bar. And,
which are his kids' names, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, Everson Royce.
We were on that rice tip still.
Those are some wine store owning kids' names, if you ask me.
Right?
That place only
opens. Emerson.
That place
Emerson, stop it. Stop rice. Royce, I'm not going to tell you again.
That place only opened because there was a holdup for the one that they're going to open up in Highland Park, which I'm really excited because that's adjacent to where I live. So in the time, it's just like, oh, this holding pattern because it takes so long to open a spot sometimes. It's been almost 3 years for them, it feels like. Right. That they're like, oh, we'll open up one in our district in the meantime. And then it's like, crushing. It's very good. I think it's one of the best burgers we've had in L.A., right?
Totally agree.
Yeah. Best biscuit in L.A.
Oh, we've talked about that biscuit.
Yeah, it's a fine one.
Pigtails?
Yeah, you should really go on Sunday if you're still in town, Terrence.
Yeah, if you're a biscuit fan.
Or all of the listeners.
They have a nice little outdoor space in the back. It's not just a bar. Mm-hmm. Very loungy.
Yeah.
You might run into Amretta.
Mm-hmm. You ran into Ratajkowski there?
I didn't like speak with her, but I've seen her there. It's nice.
Okay, okay.
Amrat.
Oh, boy.
What does she order?
I ran into her at Tony's bar across the street from there.
Yeah.
Oh, is that where it is? That way?
Yeah, it's right there, catty corner from Tony's and Pizza Nista.
Yeah.
And Tony's is solid.
I've never been to Pizza Nista.
Yeah, what's the vibe of Pizza Nista?
Pizza good.
It's very good.
It's good.
Sal. Like, why is everyone so into Pizza Nista?
Because it's quality. And there isn't a lot of great pizza by the slice in L.A., and it's good. I think it's
like a real nice blue collar,
affordable
pizza slice kind of place, but they put some care and love into it, and they have cool beers and stuff like that.
They just have house beer actually.
Oh really?
Mm-hmm. That's the one that's adjacent to Tony's, right?
It's the same. I think they share a wall. No, they don't. But it's just good.
Let's talk about your process with helping write a cookbook.
Ah, yes.
How much work did you do? How much work is that? Seems like a lot.
It's a ridiculous amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
It was, but super, super interesting at the same time. But it was kind of ridiculous because the way that we did it, I can tell you it's trials and tribulations.
Yeah, I want to hear these tribs.
I tell you what you shouldn't do ever first is get a book packager.
What's number one tip?
Okay, first question, what is a book packager?
Book packager kind of acts even above an agent, and they come in and see talent and help package it all together to then get you the book deal. So they're pre the book deal. So
they're a middleman.
A grabbing hand?
An evil middle hand.
Are they kind of known as the slime balls of the literary world?
Even though like I worked in publishing and stuff before, this was the first ever time I worked to do a book. And basically, we did the pilot. I wrote, produced that, but for the cookbook deal, it was just floating about. Someone approached Dante, a book packager, did it all.
BP.
Went and got you that deal.
They smelled blood in the water.
But guess what their deal was?
Mm.
Ooh.
They take 50%.
50%
of the fee.
Feed it out.
No.
Really?
And then as soon as they get it and get you the deal, they step away. They disappear.
Yeah, they've got they're not helping at all.
Exactly. And we didn't know what we were
doing. You're welcome.
It's just for...
Yeah. So they get you the deal. They 100% get you the deal. And we were actually got a deal with Sterling Epicure, which is like a super kind of old school... It wasn't the right place for us, but it's an old school publisher that puts out Gordon Ramsay books normally. Like just stayed-up books.
Yeah, you're more of a 10-speed press type of...
We hope... Well, now, I know, but yeah.
So on paper,
an
exhilarating deal and offer on the table. Hard to say no to.
Wow, they just set it up and walk away with half.
Exactly. So you get that first. So that's the first bit. The second bit is just working with an editor on the other side, which is really interesting, but also I think... Arguably, when we were also doing it, a lot of this kind of younger, cooler, interesting, art-inspired cookbooks weren't the norm.
Right.
So we had to follow a lot of rules, and that was also just really weird. So little things for that would be like, well, they're the rules that matter that we just didn't know about that actually are what makes it a really fucking hard process. Like a recipe editor, they would come in, and I guess because we were this small little thing, we wouldn't get our hands held through it. We were kind of told what to do and then just left and then had to kind of do it. So if you haven't ever edited a recipe properly, we thought we could give the recipes and their editor would do it. They wouldn't. They would just come in and tell you what was wrong with yours and you'd have to figure out how to redo everything. Mm. So that was the first one on that kind of stuff. But that was cool because, you know, that's the way it's got to be done. But we were at this point where literally, say, for the cover, we went in and we worked with these amazing creative directors who were partners in Dante, who had been there since the beginning. Like they created that aesthetic, the truck they saw around, they did everything. And they're all professional, you know, they run amazing design studios.
Mm-hmm.
We were literally offered three options. You could either have this option A, chef holding food, option B, no chef, title only, or option C, some meatpacking paper or something. equally as, you know, trots.
So keys to the kingdom. Whatever you wanted, you could have.
Yeah.
The exact opposite. I was just kidding. That sounds like an absolute nightmare.
So there was that first. And then what was crazy was the ideas of stuff. So I just think it was, you know, it's like a label. You were just on the wrong home. So we put in all our stuff. So Dante, the whole idea of the book was, without going to get into serious, but, you know, this was quite a few years ago, and it was all about fried chicken. Well, he's called Dante Fried Chicken. But what we tried to create was this idea of social anthropology and food history, and be really inspired by the movement of food from Africa, because he has a really interesting story. His grandfather's like Jimmy Forrest, the jazz musician. His grandmother was one of the first black ladies in the South to create kind of a social club. You know, it was really interesting. We wanted to tell these stories.
Carrying the torch.
Which is basically, you know, in a weird way, that's what every single discussion about ethnic food is now, is all about these kind of ideas about identity and where you're coming from and everything, which we try to talk about. And that arguably got kind of pushed out.
That's so frustrating. Yeah.
And even down to the titles of, you know, at the time it was like kind of rap inspired or whatever, but we had these kind of titles for dishes, and they came in and just killed them all. And we're like, no, it has to be more normal. It has to be this. Which we were like, all right, well, we'll take your... You know, you guys know what's up. So, so it's hard. But we got on, you know, also we launched it. We got on Oprah for like the best fried chicken, you know, little segment.
Oh, wow.
That's small
time. Which is dope.
Wow.
And then that was it. And then they hosted one dinner for press, and then they just disappeared.
Oh, God, you think they would just take the Oprah and run? If you're a book publisher, that's what she does, is she breaks books, for God's sake, specifically.
Well, the frustrating thing, too, from... The takeaway to me from that story is that they want to kill the cultural anthropology aspect, the idea that makes it interesting, unique, and also pushes it beyond a cookbook without being mutually exclusive from making the cookbook less accessible. So you've got the story that is really interesting and inviting and makes you appreciate so much more than just the food on its face, and they're telling you, dumb that down. So it's not only like, we know this is a good idea, but you're also saying it's not important.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is like just literally offensive on its face.
You know how gung-ho you go in when you go into something like this. And we thought, you know, without kind of over-egging it, but we thought we could kind of change things a bit. Like, let's go in and talk about black culture, talk about it within an interesting way. And it kind of just got so...
Why wouldn't you? Like, why would you be like, no, let's not do that. Let's not do something interesting, meanwhile also having a great cookbook. Why would you somehow tell yourself or tell somebody else who's doing that, no, don't do that. It's like it's just so counterintuitive to making something compelling.
It's kind of wild. But it's also the flip was, it was obviously a really fucking amazing experience to still do it. And going back to what Jason, what you were saying, like the idea of how you did it, I approached it basically like a massive interview. So we built out all the chapters, all like a magazine. And then I basically spent hours Skyping with Dante, would transcribe everything and rewrite it in his voice, which is how I quote unquote ghost wrote the book. Right. But also these things, like, we didn't know, so we didn't sign the right contracts. So my name isn't on the cover, because of contractually it wasn't allowed to be on the cover. But if you open it, as soon as the second page, it says written by Terrence Tay. Mm-hmm. But little things like this, like, I didn't know. We went into it blind.
Well, it's funny you're saying what a learning experience it was. Just hearing you talk about it for the last 10 minutes, I feel like I've learned so much. I had no idea about the process of writing cookbooks.
I tell you, the one thing that is pretty interesting was, you know, a sad story, but Dante's mother was really sick throughout making it, and so it's dedicated to her, and she passed away during making this book. And so Dante just went AWOL. Like, he was just like, and obviously understandable, but we had to finish the
100%,
book.
100%, of course.
So I had to literally sit down and write in this way that I wasn't even taking his words and helping rewrite them, basically editing them. I had to just...
You were doing an impression of him.
I was doing an impression of him. And it was this chapter about smoking and barbecue. And I have no... I learned a lot
put it in the air?
Just the tip. And it's so I had to talk about, and it was kind of amazing, because I literally had to think about remembering the first time when we flew Dante over to do an event, and he was like, I want to barbecue. And we, in Britain, barbecuing is not barbecuing. It's like literally putting some sausages on the grill. So we ordered all these barbecues for this event, like, as in quote unquote grills. And he turned up and he was like, what the fuck is this?
Where's the smoker,
where's
dog?
The smoker?
Why am I surrounded by a bunch of Webers right now?
Where aren't the Webers? And so what was good was I learned a ton of shit from that. And so I had to recreate that chapter from pretending to be Dante, or from Dante's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
But one good thing about doing all those events is literally my entire backyard was then in the end full of no shit. We had like 5 Webers, industrial rice cookers, and just everything.
Nice. That's awesome.
Which I just gave away.
How much of it do you feel like? I mean, obviously now in 2016, the world of cookbooks and food media is so much more loose and open and liberal with exploring new shit. Like, is it frustrating seeing your idea just being a few years a little too early?
Nah, I'm super cool with it. I was like,
hopefully it's vindicating.
Obviously, it's
to
a shame, but you know, the book is still real. It's out there. It's, you know, it's in the bookstores. We're just a little bit too early, but it's cool. It's fine. You know, a funnier one on another story is, which we could even talk about this on this, is Maya's girlfriend who then has her own cookbook.
Oh, yeah.
With a little project that we started together. But I'm chill with that, too. So, yeah, shout-outs to that.
We don't need to...
The funny thing about...
We didn't give that book a plug.
Nope.
To me, the idea of writing a recipe... I've only done it once. Actually, like, really, really writing down a recipe for publication. It was like just a blog. Asked a friend and I to do something. And I just said, sure. And then... I started writing the recipe and I was like, this is so hard.
Yeah.
This is not like quarter cup blank, quarter cup blank, quarter cup blank. It's really like really defining every physical action from start to finish.
It's really tricky.
I was blown away.
It's an interesting exercise.
Yeah, pull out the eggs. It's like,
I thought
it's
it was
going to
take me
steps. 10
minutes in an email. Yeah, yeah, and like exactly. 6 hours later, I looked up and I was like, oh, still needs a polish.
I mean, it should take days, really, you know?
It'd be funny to dig out like what they gave us as their kind of guidelines of how you've got to do it. Because it was very, obviously, it's got to be done. It's got to be functional. But there is one massive typo in the Dante book, which no one caught, which was making hot sauce, and it was supposed to be like a teaspoon or a tablespoon of sugar, and it says a cup of sugar. So who knows if anyone's actually done that and if it's fucked up.
Oh no, I always wonder about that
a lot of
too.
It that's a lot.
I usually cut
a teaspoon to a cup.
I usually cut sugar at least in half in almost every recipe I make, and then I'll finish with the rest if I really think it needs that much. But just my palate in general, I don't eat sweets. I don't eat desserts usually unless they're, you know, someone's like, you gotta try this. Mm-hmm. But like every time I look at a recipe and it says like cup of sugar, half cup of sugar, I'm like, nope, yeah. Doesn't need that much. And if it does, I'll finish with it. Because sugar is one of those things where you can always finish a sauce with sugar.
Yeah.
Totally. Like it's not something that needs to start as a base. It doesn't really help anything else out. And if anything, it's going to burn the earlier it goes in. But like to me, it's always like, pro tip, if you're kind of suspicious about how sweet something's going to be, do half and then finish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found that a lot with even doing this cookbook or even the stuff that I was doing afterwards when we were like doing like vegan kimchis and all this kind of stuff. And obviously when you start, you base your stuff off other things out there.
Of course.
Out to the Momofuku kimchi
as you build.
Recipe.
Right?
But then you realize like, so the Momofuku kimchi recipe, if you go through it, I think it asks for something like 20 cloves of garlic. And that could be OG Korean grandmother style.
Right. Mm.
But arguably, not everyone has to do it with you can. We did it with like four, and it's fine.
It's differentiating flavors with garlic. It's like hit and miss. Yeah, you never know.
It's gonna mellow as it ferments, but it's still a lot.
That's a lot of fucking garlic.
Yeah.
And then there's a point where you're like, I'm making kimchi, and it calls for 20 cloves of garlic, and then you're like, blind taste test. Like this one has 10. This one has 30 cloves.
Yeah.
This one has 20. Can you tell the difference?
Hardly.
I don't even know if David Chang could tell the difference.
I think every single kimchi recipe needs to start with buy a pair of disposable gloves.
Yeah.
Almost. Like just don't ever.
Don't buy a pair. Buy a box.
I stained my hands red for 4 days making kimchi once, not realizing that it really helps.
Well, my friend, a friend of mine, he was a line cook at Pot. Roy Choi's spot,
sure,
and he would have to make industrial amounts of it, and he showed me a picture of him making kimchi in a plastic Rubbermaid garbage can, and he would wear black rubber gloves,
up to the shoulder, right, or
up to the shoulder,
elbow, or
duct tape wrapped around it up to his shoulder.
Oh, it's so gnarly!
And just like, oh, you're the tallest guy here, you have the longest arms, so you're the one who just. Both arms up to your armpit in a garbage can.
He looked like he was a stand-in for Breaking Bad, but you're like, that's a biohazard suit.
He looked like a coroner. I'm just like, oh, you're like, oh, you get to do the worst job here, by the way. He's like, can I just Can I clean up the vomit in the bathroom and say, like, no, 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 no. You get to toss the
Does computer anybody have any
can.
Explosive diarrhea I could go clean up because...
Okay, bad no. guy from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Please, please, no.
Stewie's
that's my go-to. That's my...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, I'm trying to bring these go-to. Los Angeles, you know... Joke reference points.
Oh, just animated film noir, no big deal.
A little Paramount or Universal, wherever that thing was shown.
We all remember that.
Universal. Where'd you go to dinner last night, homie? Mr. Tay?
We went to He's Looking at You in K-Town.
Give it up.
I've heard some things.
What'd you think?
Give it up.
Give it up. That's the tagline right there. Sorry.
Hey, don't know about the name personally, but some people like it, some people don't. I'm down, you know.
I would say I think I'm a not my favorite bit. Name.
Yeah, I'm
but
I'm,
not I'm don't hate it.
I've heard good things about that spot.
What have you heard?
I just heard it was like an interesting little place that's doing. Are they doing prefix menus in Koreatown, or is it like sort of like that?
They're trying to do. Well, they're looking to break up that idea of Koreatown. Like, I think basically, this is that kind of Yelp blurb or whatever, but it comes down to that fact of Koreatown was where back in the day you could kind of roll around and have fun. It wasn't just to have easy, low, you know, that whole argument about why does ethnic food cost so, why is it always so cheap? And if you go to Koreatown, is everyone just expecting a cheap meal, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they really wanted to inject that in Koreatown. This is what I heard anyway, with kind of a more, Asian inspired, Korean inspired, but not a Korean restaurant, and they're saying that out front, and also up it a little bit, like get people spending a bit more money, have a you know, have it arguably new American.
I think I saw on the most recent Chef's Night Out, it was Jessica from Squirrel and her whole crew. They went there on the day one, which it was, and Ari was on there too. Ari from
yeah, give him a month.
Don't go yeah, it was hilarious. That was really, really funny.
Give him a couple months.
Because Ari called out Jessica for doing that, and I honestly see both sides, because that's, I mean, if you kill it, like, that's great press, but then if you're, Ari's point of view is like, that sounds so stressful and like the worst day. Mm-hmm. But the chef was like, cool as a cucumber, so confident. He's like, he explained his whole dish. He's like,
what did he say about
it? It worked out in his favorite. Yeah, he said, what's up? But yeah, it was specifically like SoCal-inspired food, not even like New America. You know, just like just a kid growing up in South Orange County.
Oh, is that where
with
from?
Mexican heritage. So there's like some Mexican notes and then like, you know, SoCal-Mexican, you know, dining, like homages and nods. And the space looked really pretty.
Andy's ex-animal. Well, both of them are.
Yeah, that's right.
Him, the ops manager.
Exactly.
Was it just a regular dinner, or was it like a special thing that you went to?
It was a regular dinner, but it was kind of like a fun regular dinner club dinner.
Oh, wow.
What does that mean?
A bunch of cool dudes have a monthly dinner.
So, it's like, so Roy Choi.
There was Roy.
Who else?
There was Big R. Big R was in the building for sure.
Was Bourdain there?
Total King. He wasn't there, unfortunately. Dan the Automator.
Okay.
Who's known for his undercover love of food.
Was David Cho there?
No.
David Cho wasn't. I expected him to be. Omid Fatimi.
Ah, the god.
Okay.
Film god.
So it's just a bunch of cool dudes.
Adam from Stussy. Mm-hmm. Adam Wiseman.
Yeah.
It's King.
My guy.
Eddie Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. It was fun.
Was Terry Crews there?
Nice fella.
No?
Okay. Should have been. Checking. I think he was sitting at the bar.
How did you get on this list, dog? Must be nice.
Just hanging. I had a little, you know, just a little hang.
What was the best thing you ate there?
Let's talk about the foods.
Okay, yeah. So the place itself, I think, is... A, there's the Morrissey Supreme poster framed. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit weird.
Okay.
It's a little too
streetwear-y.
It's a little on the nose.
The chef came out and he was an incredible dude. The service was insane. But he was really like, oh, yo, I worked opposite Supreme for all these years. So that's why this is there. A little homage to that, which is cool. Like, hats off. I don't think he got that Eddie Cruz was sitting in front of him because Eddie was just ripping it out of him for a little while. I think he just thought... It was just being obnoxious. But that was a really fun dinner.
Out of him is a good
Really good bunch of dudes. Like, so everyone was just, you know, they they did that thing where they just obviously serve up the entire menu.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
You gotta
and you get treated like damn kings when you show up.
You eat like kings, and it's one of those where I think you just feel a bit like first world problems when I literally carried home five boxes of extra and that I ate cold for lunch, which was fine. But I would say their tartare is awesome. On point. I think their tartare is actually really good. I know
the
that's one
tartare?
Of those. Yeah. I would say a lot of their stuff is kind of, it's almost there, but it's, and I think I said this to someone and they straight away went, well, he's from Animal, but I don't actually think that should be the way you say that. Like they do a duck, kind of like a roast duck that they chop up and then you serve it with hot sauces and arepas. Mm. But I'm like, that's literally, it's like an aioli as well. So it's like fat on fat on fat on a greasy arepa. I was like, this is just too much. It's like, mm-hmm. it's not even like dope, fun, stoner, like Moorish. It's
right,
just too,
right. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
literally
beyond
fat, on
the
fat
lily.
On fat on fat on fat.
Well, exactly. You also can't, you don't have the option in that dish to choose how much you want to consume, right?
Yeah.
Like if you got a really beautiful pork chop with a huge, like fat, heavy side, you can choose. And if it's aged and it's cooked well, you can choose how much fat you want to eat. And it's rendered and it's delicious and it's beautiful. But if you're going to take a bite of that dish, your only option is fat on fat.
Yeah, like and it looks
and that's,
amazing.
You know, that's not the way
that
I
one
love
was,
to eat.
Yeah, that
like
one was a little bit
be a little choosy.
That's K-Town, baby.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, man. I fuck
punch K-Town. In the face, yeah.
It was like classics. It was kind of like sharing stuff.
Was their tartare a standard one or anything unique about
it? Their tartare had some extra. It had either a bit of miso, a bit of something else in there. But I think we're in that place where tartares, they just should be fucking outstanding, however much you fuck with it.
Right.
And I feel
toast
that
points?
We would just say, well, there's toast on the side. You could have it. I kind of actually like to go in sans toast and just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice spoon.
I start sans toast, but like fourth bite, fifth bite.
Yeah, you need a bit.
Toast starts to come in a little. For me.
This is a good segue to this other tartare that we were talking about with me and Chris just now,
oh,
which is
kindly.
A terrible tartare.
Oh, that's a bummer.
The cannibal tartare.
But what else was fantastic, though? What was bad about the tartare?
Which one are we talking about? The cannibal tartare.
Yeah, the cannibal.
Not the chicken liver mousse, the tartare.
Yeah, the tartare.
I haven't had the tartare.
Well, the tartare sounds dope, but it's served on, it's like obviously soft, warm, pseudo-warm meat served on a blini, served with hollandaise. So it's like soft and soft and soft.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was a bit, and it served as a little bite rather than like a really, I don't know.
You kind of want the tartare to be scooped onto a real crunchy,
yeah, you want that hard
scrape
baguette.
The roof of your mouth bread so you get that nice contrast of mush and crunch.
Or just, it felt like everything was so rounded that it was a little bit inoffensive. It was just too, just safe on safe on safe.
Inoffensive. I like that.
Too many notes were played. Too many notes weren't played.
Exactly. Mm. But going back to that
no dynamic range.
There was it was only mid to lows.
in terms of their other, they kind of got beat up a lot. Also, the cannibal people are friends of mine, so it's a little weird, but.
But he's got nothing but that. When we had this text message conversation, he was like freaking out at what a great little like 1 hour happy hour vibe he got going on there.
Happy hour was amazing. So last night before I actually went to this dinner, I was out in Culver City. I had a couple of hours to kill, so I actually worked from Cannibal and managed to like hit that happy hour, and that's fucking amazing.
Had a cheeky old fashioned for five.
I had two old fashions.
All right then.
And I had a
drafty.
I had two of those, and then I went in with their free little charcuterie buffet, which
that's
is fucking
nuts.
Amazing.
Wait, what?
It's free. That's what I'm saying. This is why
we're
talking about this thing. This is nuts.
I experienced it on Saturday.
Dude.
I went in there, and it's basically
they have a happy hour charcuterie situation
going on. They set up like kind of like a 6 foot plank of wood, and it's just like, here's a big pile of shaved mortadelle. Here's a big pile of
salami. It's like tam o'shanter or something.
Whatever it is. And you just grab a couple flaps with a toothpick.
I instantly pictured myself as Dan Aykroyd from Trading Places in the Santa costume stealing the entire smoked salmon in his belt.
Yeah.
Like, how do you just not go in there with a big purse and just scoop the entire thing into a bag and be like, thanks for the $5 old-fashioned. Gotta go.
Is there security standing around
the charcuterie buffet? Sorry.
That Jason's like saying there's toothpicks. That makes it sound like you're at one of those freebie tasters.
Yeah, it's not dainty.
It's not dainty. They give you plates and real cutlery. Like pre-9/11 cutlery. You can go in...
This is pre-9/11 cutlery.
Like it's a happy hour where you think...
So everybody gets a box cutter as soon as they walk in? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
You get real cutlery, real plates, and you can just go in on there.
And also, and instead of just having like a little day-old toasted baguette, there's like a bowl with like full pieces of bread.
Like beautiful bread. And then... I guess they do something kind of new each time. And so yesterday's one, which was a shout out to Jimmy Jolliffe. It was basically a country ham kind of marmalade that they made.
Really?
And that was just sitting there.
Like a spread for toast.
Like a country ham meat spread.
Chopped ham.
Something like that in that vein where it's like meant to be spread.
Yeah, and they were super nice. They were like really good. You know, I was there like, I guess it was a happy hour. Everyone wanted to drink. I had to finish some work. I was the only one there fucking with a laptop out. Mm-hmm. They were super cordial and actually made me not feel like a dick.
Nice.
Yeah, that's
and then I was there. I popped in a little bit earlier and just even tried their salad bar.
What are you talking about? A salad bar?
Salad bar?
In the charcuterie bit. By you know, on their normal hours, they have like couple carts and salads and stuff just to take away.
Oh, okay. like a New York style takeaway. Yeah, kind of thing,
right? Vibes. Yeah,
so they've got.
Yeah. And they gave me a little slice of roast beef for free, little toaster. I was very impressed with it.
Did you try the chicken liver pate or the chicken liver mousse?
Do they still serve that though? Was that just at our dinner?
Is that the one that got rinsed?
It's on the menu,
and it's with matcha.
Yeah, it's infamously hated on by everyone.
Is it like beyond me and you? Because we were like, we did that dinner there and everything was really good except for one that was like such a miss that it was like I just assumed the night that we ate it, something went wrong. Like somebody fell asleep and like they followed the cookbook and they put a cup of sugar instead of a tablespoon of sugar. People constantly sleep
at restaurants.
They put a cup of matcha instead of a tablespoon.
I just assume that that's what happened.
That's funny.
Well, no, I think there was an Eater article talking about like various like restaurant reviewers being like, what in the world are we eating? Like we have this chicken liver mousse and then you add this green tea matcha powder to it, which is like a interesting bold choice, but it turns it from like a usually
it
like
it becomes very bitter and it overpowers any of the subtleness of anything in the pate. Like it's really bizarre.
And then superficially, it turns it from like a nice appetizing pink color to like kind of a baby shit green.
I don't mind the Slimer green. It's fine. I'm fine with that.
I can't handle foul colors with my food.
I'm so okay with colors. No, they don't bother me at all.
It has to be a really dimly lit restaurant for me to be okay. That's where I really can't hang.
He made a smoked brisket sandwich on a Martin's potato roll with Carolina mustard, barbecue sauce, and coleslaw, and
you're back, baby.
I was in heaven.
Damn. He never left. To me, it was like that was just a missed dish. To me, I mean, there were like seven or eight things that we ate that night, and only one wasn't good, and most were actually like.
But I kind of applaud them for, despite all of the flack that they've received on this baby shit chicken liver mousse, that they still kept it on the menu.
I don't ride for that at all.
Let's see how long do you think it's going to stay on?
I have no idea, but if I'm on date night and that is occupying part of my economic real estate for the evening. And I get that, and I'm just like, oh, you guys just did that to spite everybody else telling you how horrible it is? I'm going to be like, dick move. Dick move.
Interesting.
Like if it just gets chosen, and you're just like, it's like those when you're on a date, and they're like, don't share.
Yeah. Well, I mean, pate is a classic opener. It's one of my favorite things in the universe. It's
the best.
You can graze on it. You get the
toast. It can hang for the whole meal.
Yeah, it can linger almost the duration. It's great. Like you can throw it in the pasta. I was like, whoa, what's this all about? This is nice. Especially, I always think of Alimento when I think of the pate.
Well, that's
and the bread that you get.
You're just jumping into the Cadillac, homie.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like that pate is a great, and the bread that comes with it is a great vessel for everything you're gonna eat that whole night. Any sauce, like a little bit. Ooh, there's a little pate. And it's like ooh.
So are you a smooth or coarse man, Chris?
They're not. To me, honestly, they're not mutually exclusive. But I want to hear your answer.
I definitely like both, but I prefer smooth. I prefer smooth.
I like that French country.
I like that.
Well, I think with chicken liver, smooth. I like it smooth. With pork liver, like a country pate, yeah. I like it more rustic and chunky. So pork chunk, chicken smooth.
And do you mind when they whip in a little dairy in there?
I'm okay with that.
No, yeah. I don't mind at all.
If it's good, I don't. I'm totally
if it works,
okay
it works.
Dairy meaning just clarified butter,
a little heavy cream.
No, more when they go a bit creamy.
More of a yeah.
cream. I like it when because it's always got to have that butter.
Yeah, of course. I'm more of a just heaps of butter is good. Yeah, I don't cool think we need to add cream to it.
I'm okay yeah, with the cream. Too. I mean, it does. It cuts the metallic taste slightly depending on like what the batch is like and what you have. I don't mind that.
Where so in LA iterations. Is there? So you know, in like in New York, you've got those classic French restaurants.
Yeah.
That kind of just do that kind of thing like incredibly well. Where in LA has that? Where would you go for that?
Petit Trois.
Comme ça used to do it pretty well.
Is Petit Trois still as good as what? I imagine it's a bit.
Petit Trois is exceptional. I love it.
Depending on what you get.
It's also very understated in how, I think, how lauded it is. The experience of being inside is not precious in a good way.
It's a bistro, yeah.
Yeah, it really feels like you just walked out of a hotel in Paris and you don't know where to eat.
And you go downstairs.
And you're like, there's a lot of brass and tile. I guess we should eat there. It's really nice.
And it's to me. Cool. No reservations. You wait. You have a drink. The drinks are great. They're you know, nobody's like trying to.
What part of town is it?
Oh, it's like catty corner from Moza. Yeah,
right
it's in the belly of the food beast, or one of the food beasts, one of 15 food beasts in the
city. You haven't had the omelet there?
The Boursin omelet.
Mm-hmm.
Omelet. I haven't had that or the
tartare.
The burger.
Burger. Chicken confit, fried chicken. That's confit is great.
I say for a man of your exceptional palate,
escargot.
The omelet is the only thing you should really go for.
No way. Escargot is great. It's like
escargot
great.
Escargot is okay.
I think it's like French comfort food, but
very much so.
Well executed.
In a good way.
Yeah, but the problem is French comfort food means a pound of butter. I mean, like the escargot.
That's why I never eat French.
The escargot is great, and it's so much butter.
It's great.
What's the jump up between petit and toimet?
So it's just eating a plate of bacon, but you don't want to do it.
That's not true.
What's the step up, or what's the difference?
What's the difference?
Well, it's
petit toimet. Tuamek is just tasting, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
an adventurous.
Tuamek is a super experimental prefix tasting menu, and then Petit Trois is just classic French bistro, no frills, just straight
which
away.
Which is adhering very much to not trying to experiment or play with the idea of a French bistro. It is literally like if you took a slice out of a Pixar movie of what a French bistro looks like, that's what it
steak is. Steak au pois with frites.
In a great way. Like you mentioned, it doesn't really, it's not ubiquitous. It doesn't really exist in LA. It's not part of LA's food culture.
I mean, Tex is like the divey French spot in Echo Park, like, and I love it.
We got the moule frites. It was really good, man.
Moule frites
Their
were good.
Burger is great.
I ordered good. So badly there.
Oh,
what'd you do?
I kind of tried to roll with a girl.
You went for the jambalaya linguine?
I went for the anchovies. You know, they're going to have a little smoked fish. It's going to be kind of... And it turned up with alternating layers of salty fish and apple.
Oh, no. Ooh. No, you got to go salad, burger, moule frites, anything involving
French
fries
onion?
There. Yeah, the
French onion
is good.
Very good.
Great happy hour. One of the better places to watch a Dodger game in L.A.
Agreed.
100%.
That's the problem. There's just so many restaurants in this world where if you don't know the right thing to order, you're going to have a horrible experience.
It's 100%
true. Which
is
unfortunate because you shouldn't have horrible shit on your menu.
Yeah, the menu's too big, that's for sure. But they've gotten better. They've scaled it back. I mean, I've been going there for years because I happen to live like so close to it. And the bar
what
was
What do you say? Thai? Tay?
Tex. Tex, I believe.
I think like Tex Men.
Yeah.
I say however T-E-X. You say it, it's annoying.
I agree. So, but I want to know a little bit more about, so you're doing a food film festival.
Yeah, I like that.
Yes.
And it's your test of case going into New York, or is it open to the public? Or
yeah, so it's the first one, not really open to the public in that way. So we want to do off the back of doing all this different stuff and... It kind of started with that idea of food film being represented in a really weird way online and just stuff that I wasn't really into. Kind of what Jason was talking about before, about like it's all, you know, the same thing and it's all getting really boring. And so I started a magazine, you know, digital magazine, so videos and all that. And we wanted to basically create this thing that was just an alternative to all the other food media at the time. And like kind of harking back, it was kind of when I was in that very much Power Ranger fuck place, magazines like Kinfolk, like fuck this idea of an aspirational white lifestyle that didn't,
right,
that had nothing to do with food.
I'm really tired of seeing bundled sticks placed on top of a nice rustic 100%.
And what is
pastels?
And every shot, you know, all the photography looks exactly the same, and all this stuff. All this idea of like, oh, the other flip has to be, if you're talking about ethnic people, has to be about community. And it's like, yo,
we're gonna give back to these Ugandans.
Exactly. And the fucking, yeah, the state of science Senegal is popping. We want to bring that back. And so I just tried to create something that, with a couple of people, that was a little bit different from that. And then basically fast forward a few years, and the idea was like, turn it into a food film festival, because A, on that again, let's just open it all up. No one can spend money online, except if you're Vice, but then all your money is only because of investment. Like, no one makes money online.
Yeah, it's just fronted, it's insane.
Right.
Yeah, you can't make money. So I was trying to do it as a publication, like a digital publication. And when we first launched, we got loads of commercial projects. So Patron and Mercedes to do food shit and all this kind of stuff. And then smart, I was like, this is like, it was smart, but at the same time, it just felt like I was wasting my time trying to put the money in. I was like, how do you do something a bit different? And I still don't think there's a film festival out there that caters to everyone, say, who's sitting around this table. Like, there's a place where you can probably see Jonathan Gold's doc open at Sundance or something, but there's no thing about smaller, just great films. And especially that idea of having interesting food stories that aren't tied into like a theme, or they're not, it's not, you know, it's not shoehorned in on the backside, right, of something.
But if you take City of Gold out of the conversation about food documentaries, and you kind of remove Chef's Table, like if you take Netflix out of it, it's like the Jonathan Gold documentary is the only of its kind to be on a screen in, I don't know when, 20 years? Yeah. I can't name another 100%. One.
I would say
it's ubiquitous because it's, I think it's very good, and it's, you know, we've talked about it on the show. I think it's very good, but it's also, There's so much more space for similar things. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, tons.
But I just wanted to say that because it's like, to me, you're like, oh, you can see the Jonathan Gold document, but like, yeah, that's the only one you can see. Yeah,
exactly.
Do one on Alice Waters. There's a million. Dude, please. Like, it's just endless. Oh, God. It's such a simple format. But not simple.
But also, much like you were saying, it's hard to make money online in content. Some might argue the same about documentary filmmaking.
100%. Like, the idea would be that if this thing grows, you put money back into this. But on a black and white level, I thought, hey, why don't you create something that you can just sell hard tickets to, and at least we can have this business going, and at least we can create something and support your friends.
You will just find out very quickly, is there an audience or is there not an audience?
Exactly. And it's cool. And we're starting off on October the 11th in New York. Neue Haus out there is really, you know, graciously supporting, but it's also the idea of they've got a really beautiful screening room.
Yep.
We've got Gerardo from Lalo, ex El Rey, doing vegan chicharrones as like the snacks instead of popcorn. And it's just kind of like, we're just going to keep it fun.
Let's talk about what a vegan chicharrone is.
Yes.
I think that was the spin-in so that we got the members club to sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just those Taco Locos.
Oh. Everyone's
been doing, right?
Mm-hmm. This is so funny.
Can you explain that to somebody who might not be aware of this?
This was my favorite thing I ate this week.
Yeah, I want to hear from you because I have it through a
Well, that's good because we're approaching the part of our show where we talk about the best thing we ate all week. So
dang near.
Why don't you hit that, Andre?
Well, that was a smash cut. That was a hard cut into our favorite segment. So Toasty Locos is a Mexican Chicano treat, definitely like very prevalent on the east side of L.A. I was working in Boyle Heights. We were filming And our hero was born and raised in Boyle Heights, and it was a short doc about him, and he made this website called Fruitly, which is twofold. It maps all the public fruit trees and vegetables growing in neighborhoods, and then it also connects people if they want to trade food, like if they're growing stuff in their backyard and they've got too many tomatoes and they can't can them. So
it's Grindr really, for fruit.
Really interesting guy. Really, like, very motivating, exciting guy. But I was like, where's the best Toasty Locos? And before I could finish my sentence, he was just like, follow me. And we went down into Mariachi Square, and it was it was magnificent. But so Tosti Locos are basically you take any kind of corn chip, Tostitos, whatever, you know, whatever you want, split it open, dump in an ungodly and beautiful amount of hot sauce. You add Mexican peanuts, mango, cucumber, jicama.
Dang.
What else is in there? Some cheese, and then pickled pigskin. So the opposite of chicharrones, mm-hmm. which is basically that same skin that you would fry, and instead it gets pickled. And it gets all dumped in that. And that bag is split open like a plate. And then a fork.
Like a Frito pie.
Yeah, and a fork is just shoved in it and pushed in front of you. And it, I mean, it was just like, it was one of those times where I had zero guilt eating it, even knowing that it was maybe the worst thing I'd eaten in an entire month. I was like, well, I just don't have this every day. And it was so much fun. Okay. And it was great.
I've never had that before.
Oh, it's so good.
I've never toasted.
But you have to, I mean, all the profile of it, there's no sweet. Mm-hmm. So the entire profile is vinegar, it's acid, you know, it's hot sauce, it's pickles, it's salt. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a very specific profile that is like literally ham-fisted right at me. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are all the things that I really like.
That sounds great. I'm trying to find what the version that he's going to do is.
I'm sure it's going to be great. I mean, this is the concept of it. I mean, it's like a different Frito pie, and Frito pie is fantastic too.
It's really good.
So, you know, I love that idea of just like taking open a bag of chips and using that as your palate and just going wild.
Hitting it with a dump.
Because it.
I had a bugle for the first time.
Oh! Big fan of the bugles across the table here in the Yellow Patagonia.
I enjoy crunchy. A bugle.
My mind was blown.
They're pretty good.
Textually fantastic.
Was that a bugle pun that you just dropped right now?
They're also totally unique. There is no other chip that resembles a bugle in the universe, or at least that I've come across.
You can't even call it a chip?
No.
It's a damn snack.
It's a unicorn of the snack world.
It is. It's a
crisp.
It's like a salty miniature ice cream cone.
And they make them in nacho, and they do a sweet salt version. They do like a caramel corn version
of
a bugle.
Yeah, it's like I think it's that amazing, weirdly American engineered way that the thing just collapses in your mouth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think you get the bugle, a little bit of creme fraiche inside, a little caviar on top.
Damn.
Off you go, bro.
That's the thing. Rexler's. Like, what's the vibe of it there? I read this thing about Rexler's trying to bring back caviar or trying to make sure it's chill. And I just wanted to ask.
I don't know. I haven't read this. Been. Where was this? Or somewhere?
I guess it was LA Weekly this last week, but it was about...
Really high-end, sustainable...
It's about really
caviar
good...
Farm?
Yeah. And trying to go, okay, let's. How do we figure
about
this out?
Wexler's doing that.
I did not hear about that.
Because he makes all of his own smoked fish and meats and pastrami's and all that stuff in house,
works.
Bagels,
yeah.
Everything.
Yeah,
I think they said he makes everything in house except for the cream cheese.
Yeah. It's Philly,
and what which is just Philly,
which is Philly. Yeah,
but he was talking about how he wants to do that, apply that same work into caviar, which is kind of interesting. Like just the idea of like, hey, I'm just going to start making my own caviar.
It's bizarre to me because I know very little about caviar. But I just always thought it was one of those dishes that just lives on its own single ingredient. There's not really a process. It's more about
You just scoop
farming the actual ingredient.
You scoop it out of a fish and put it into a metal tin, and then you just start adding zeros.
Again, maybe some salt. Prefacing those this zeros. With not knowing anything about caviar. Mm-hmm. But just assume that it was it was a very specific fish in a certain ocean, and that's how they differentiate, and that's it.
There's a little bit of subtlety, like when you get like a really nice high grade sushi, where it's just like you're just eating fish, but like the man has cut it and prepared it in all these little subtle intricate ways that have made it taste a little bit better than the competition. I'm sure some of that goes into the caviar making and packaging as well.
But I could also picture that entire process of trying to harvest that caviar. Basically being like a clear cut and burn of the entire ocean until you find the one fish that's worth everything else that you destroyed in the process.
Yeah. Or if you're an amateur caviar farmer.
Yeah, that's right.
What,
that too.
What the...
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that seems a little like when you're like, oh, I'm just going to go like shoot a duck. I'm going to drive an hour away and shoot a duck and then like cook it up. I'm going to be like a hunter-gatherer forager man.
Shout out to Jeff.
It's going to be a lot tougher with the caviar.
Just so
I'm just going to like just cut a bunch of fish open until I see some eggs and just scoop that on a bellini. Like, I think I did it. Oh, it's so dark.
A little bluegill.
We got some low country caviar, brother. Mm.
She's Prager's. Get the spoon.
Yeah. Plastic spoon.
Big mouth. Billy caviar.
On that one, though, that I didn't find out. I found out arguably relatively recently, which I don't know if this is a known thing, but black cod and sable, same thing.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
That Nobu black cod is that Russ and Daughters smoked sable.
Yeah. Interesting.
Interesting.
Nobu black cod.
Best thing we ate.
Best thing I ate this week. There's a couple things. I had some tacos on Suadero tacos.
Always the best thing you ate.
The last two nights in a row.
Eat that seven nights in a row. It's going to be just as good.
Just good.
Yeah. But
too good.
But that one's been in the that arrow's been in the quiver for many a year. But I went to
it's been quivering.
I went to Night Market Song to visit my new friend Kim, and they have a new special on the menu. When you go to like a Thai place and they'll have the little cream cheese crispy wontons.
No, of course.
They do
crab rangoons.
Yeah. Again, something that does not exist in England.
But right. NYC, you can't like cross the street without tripping over a crab rangoon.
Mm-hmm. But that they do
for East Coast.
They do basically a crab rangoon, and it's served on a bed of like a sweet vinegar sauce with cucumbers and fresh chopped onions. But they have a really nice high quality blue crab in there instead.
Dang, man.
Just really nice. Super high quality blue crab in the rangoon.
On a hot summer night, sounds good.
Me like a lot.
Ooh, it was good. I mean, it's basically just like, you know, when you go to a nice sushi place and you get a blue crab hand roll, a little blue crab, a little bit of just a nubbin of cream cheese in there with the rice and the seaweed, and it's so creamy and decadent.
Fats on fats.
Well, going back to your conversations about texture and things, soft on soft on soft, crab rangoon is the definition of hard on soft.
Mm-hmm.
Like, exactly. It's so nice.
Perfect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Never fails.
Soft, warm, and mushy in the middle.
And crispy.
Crunchy on that outside, baby.
Yeah, it goes beyond hard almost. It goes airy. And, yeah.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm gonna
poof, crunch.
I'm going to get that very soon.
Mm-hmm. Paired with a really nice glass of chilled white wine.
And some frame hustlers from the 80s on the wall.
You can only get that at Night
Markets. Does it get better?
Night markets. Wine is always so good. Mm-hmm. The food is just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best. I don't know if I've ever had a complaint about Night Market other than waiting because it's popular.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny because the interior, you go to places that try that hard or at least think that they're going to try and do something kitschy but fun and relevant and enjoyable, and it misses so hard. And to me, the interior of Night Market is just like fire perfect, spot on.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it's just you can tell that nobody, like the people who are in charge of making it look how it looks, are not dorks.
Yeah, no,
and that's
great.
How most restaurants are.
And a good recurring thing on this podcast, I listen to regular listeners to this.
Damn, we got two now.
Cheerio.
Damn,
Chris Jewett's restaurant merch game, and I gotta say, Night Market's restaurant merch, some of the best.
Their merchandise is really, really
good. I gotta say though, it's like. I bought a couple of teas and they shrink the fuck out. So just get
that's a bummer, man.
Get a better blank. Get a better blank.
Yeah.
Get a better blank.
Can you listen?
Bump it up. That shows how janky it is.
Run that up the flagpole. Yeah.
Get that. It's get a better blank. But I'm just gonna keep on buying them.
But also take a page out of my tall book and cold water wash hang dry. You got to. And you got you have a minimal shrinko. Stewie, best thing you ate all week.
I'm gonna show some love to neighborhood that I'm leaving, actually. My last day at Burger Lord's was on Sunday. Last Sunday. So I'm out. So the last... it was my last day. I went to Lao Tao. No, sorry. Hey, whatever. It was one of my last days. Lao Tao, they were a Taiwanese food truck.
Mm.
I think they got some nice press. They're upstairs next to Ramen Champ in the Far East Plaza in Chinatown, Los Angeles.
I saw that opening.
There's soft openings of like 11 to 3 Tuesday or Wednesday through Sunday. And I have a friend from Burger Lords who, his name's Wei Chow, what up Wei, who's cooking over there as well. And he made me like a little off-menu joint. It's called the Beef Ban Mian. It's this super specific flat noodle that they do. I guess it's like this like Taiwanese staple. It's like what you got to do. Like their whole vibe is street food. So slow cooked, like braised beef, Chinese five spice. These noodles. Sorry, 8 hour spicy bone marrow broth. So it's like it was intense. It was I was feeling the pain. Napa cabbage, pickled cukes, but he added sweet corn just to balance the crunch. Mm. And it was like, ooh, boy. And that then good. Asked for Wei Chow to hook up the corn. And it was very, very good.
Wei Chow. But
yeah, I'm out of Burger Lords. It's next, bittersweet. Dude. What's next is I'm finna wait tables and then just make more money off of. Okay, here's a little insight. Managing restaurants is really hard. It takes a lot of time. You don't get paid a lot of money. And if you have the goal of opening a place of your own or with your friends or whomever, it's really hard to manifest that while running somebody else's place. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, and I've had this conversation with a few people who are also managers, and a lot of them have either stepped back or found like a different means of making money, of paying the bills.
For sure.
To find the time.
Selling weed's a popular choice.
Exactly.
Yep.
Methamphetamines, weed, whatever you need. And so that's what, I'm not the weed or the meth, but yeah, just go back to my roots, wait some tables, still be in the industry, have more free time, be a better boyfriend, be a better friend, be a better son.
Mm-hmm. You know, just like
be around more.
Deep.
Yeah.
Vegan A's made you go deep.
It was the quickest, the very knowledgeable, like fun 5 years, but easily the quickest 5 years of my life was the time I've spent managing restaurants. It's been 5 years. Oh, it's already 2008. Yeah. So 5 years of managing restaurants, whether it's from Max Miliano to blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. It was easily the quickest 5 years. All the gray hairs came in that period, and yeah. So I'm out. Bye.
Good run though, baby.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good run.
To you,
congratulations.
Sir.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So somebody sponsor us so I can make more money off any money off of this.
There's one thing that I always actually wanted to ask. I heard those rumors of when you guys did the brothers brunch. Mm-hmm. Was your spam musubi handmade spam? Like, or did you? What was the vibe?
Yes,
it was.
That's what I heard.
There were bricks involved.
My big thing that I was just like, why? That's the only thing that I...
It was scratch.
I feel
it was
annoyed that I missed.
I made the spam, and it was two nights in a row, probably up till like 4 or 5 in the morning. Because we also made more than we needed.
How do you make...
this is why I have Terrence on the like pod, by the way.
Is it like a...
I like this.
Sausage, a really blended sausage.
Exactly that. It's exactly that. A lot of things that you would imagine, like...
Is it steam, boiled?
It's, it's a water bath. It's a low temperature water bath. So that takes just like...
You kind of make a meatloaf in a water bath.
Yep. So what we did was we ground pork shoulder along with bacon and just pure pork fat. And then added a few things like when we tested, we made a few batches before.
Quite a few, at least 3 or 4 probably.
More than a few.
And so there were elements like there was a little bit of sriracha, there was a little bit of hoisin, salt and pepper, there was like even a little bit of cinnamon. But so we got it to a place where we liked it. There was sugar and salt.
Mm-hmm. Get out.
But it's basically you're just grinding that meat, mixing, and then putting it into a water bath.
Did you have a test kitchen for like, how did you blend it so smooth?
Well, just through a meat grinder.
Just kept
it was a meat grinder on a KitchenAid, which really can like, at a certain point, it will get you. I think that comes with 3 discs of different size.
Yeah, the die.
So if when you use the smallest, it really, I mean, you can make sausage with that. It gets very, very fine.
Yeah.
And then when you, after you cook it, you press it down.
Yeah.
To make it a lot more condensed and solid.
Something heavy.
So you like put a
brick Home Depot top. Bricks wrapped in foil, and it just sat on top of another layer of foil, just pressing it down into the mold.
You guys fuck yourself even harder by slicing it and then maybe a little kind of teriyaki glaze and then pan frying every single 100%. Piece and then put them within the thing? This is actually super
that's
theoretical
exactly
because that's how
happened.
I would have wanted to eat it.
That's so
exactly.
Are you asking if we should have just done a musubi brunch on itself or like a musubi like lunch or dinner? Because the answer is probably yes.
Because
of all the work it takes to do the musubi by itself, it should have just been like all musubi.
The thing that's really funny is like musubi to me is spam musubi, and I was shout out again to my boy Omid, we're driving past outside of Pine and Crane. They have that little market, the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And we're just chatting about it, blah, blah, blah. But he was like, oh, there's this chick that does masubi. And I was like, oh, damn, they got spam masubi. Let's go. And he was like, no, no, it's like healthy, basically sushi roll.
Whack masubi. Wasubi, if you will.
What kind of wasubi is that?
No. That's like trying to get fried chicken and be healthy.
Yeah, give that
No, just be healthy in other meals and then just go whole hog.
But then it's just a sushi roll.
But that's what I kind of mean. Exactly, like, surely, yeah. So I didn't even, that actually kind of made me check myself on that idea of, fuck, I don't even know if there's other masubis except for spam masubi and everything else is just a hand roll.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, my parents have lived in Hawaii since the 90s. And
are you Hawaiian?
No, Italian. But my dad saw a stoplight go into our town, so he had to get out and go somewhere even farther away from a stoplight. But so you get like the masago, you get like the egg masubi, you have the traditional spam masubi, and then the very popular is like a chicken finger masubi. Those are usually all the only three that you see in a gas station.
The chicken ones are good.
All very edible.
Yeah.
All very delicious. Yeah. But when I get a masubi and it hasn't been like hit on a plancha or on a grill with a little bit of teriyaki, it's just not a masubi.
It's not masubi, right?
No. It's a super lazy, not fun masubi. Yeah. And then you do that one step that takes 30 seconds and you're just like, what is this wizard magic? Yeah. This is fantastic.
When you guys did that, did you bring in like a plancha and stuff?
We brought in loads of stuff.
We had
not a big boy though.
Electric grills that were basically like two small plug-in planchas because it wasn't a fully functional commercial kitchen. No. It was somewhere in between. We had space, but we just basically had a four-top gas range and brought in a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, we had a lot of juice coming in, so we had to use really long extension cords, which thank God they had.
For the first 40 minutes, were tripping the entire and popping pop-up, and all we did was blow breakers.
Oh, 100%, yeah, because you had a deep fat fryer in there?
Oh, yeah, the rice maker.
And the rice cookers?
No, that's all we did for the first 40 minutes. And nobody got food or drinks. We just blew breakers until we could finally get things turned on.
I've done that too.
It was amazing.
It was
great. Terrence, what's the best thing you ate all week?
Do I get to have, because I'm not from Los Angeles, can I have a couple?
Yes, mm-hmm. Please. As you wish. As many as you feel like firing.
All right, first up, Daiho.
Mm-hmm.
And the SGV. Just kicking it with my, all the Rough Riders.
Mm-hmm. Stop.
Know who that is.
Drop.
Explain what that is for somebody who does not know.
So I've been there a couple of times, and it's basically this. I think it's the greatest Taiwanese beef noodle soup that I've ever had. It's the deepest, the darkest red. It's that one that people literally come on Instagram. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I've never had it before until I went a couple of year and a bit ago with some friends, which I'm sure you guys know, Ben Wang and Aaron Garcia.
That's it.
On the hunt for that Taiwanese.
The gods.
And it was incredible. And so we went back there and I hadn't had it in the whole time. And like, it's one of those things where I think it's like a bow or something. It's like anyone now makes a beef noodle soup. And the big jokes was this Pine and Crane saying. But this one was ridiculous. It's so deep. I think Ben and I kind of got into talking about how they do it. I think they blend up all their spices, like grind the spices, then toast them rather than the other way around.
Huh.
I personally think there's a little bit of tomato puree or some sort of tomato sweet, like natural sweetness in there, which kind of takes it to another level.
Makes perfect sense.
It's so dark. It's like the most beautiful hue of red and brown that I've ever seen for noodle soup.
Okay.
So that's the one. And they have the best tripe salad that I have ever had.
They cut
that shit mad thin, like kind of lardo thin, and toss that with Szechuan and no chili oil. So that's what kicked off my week.
That works.
Okay.
That's beautiful. That
Number two
would be going back to what Jason was saying before, but I witnessed the election debate, which was pretty interesting.
It's a terrible idea.
That's a whole other podcast.
That is a whole other podcast. But again, we got Night Market as our eats to watch this debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had their crab fried rice. And I think it ties back to you talking about that really blue crab that you were talking about before. That was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, this just looks like a normal ass fried rice. I've had the uni akura fried rice. I've had all those, which obviously in hard. But this was ridiculous.
Yeah, man.
Across the whole dinner, you know, full spread, like six of us or something. That just plain ass crab fried rice. They went in hard, I think, with like a lot of fermented other fish things to make it more umami bombs.
Unctuous. Yes.
That was tasty. And then I would say my last thing was I went to Baru.
Drum roll.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right
on. So good.
And yeah, obviously seen those pics and the idea and that it's a Korean squirrel and wanted to go. And then we went and took a
great description. I've never heard it described as a Korean squirrel, and that is very spot on. Also, in the best possible way.
What a cute name for something.
Yeah, Korean squirrel.
Little mm-hmm. Korean squirrel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like your future girl.
Sorry to interrupt, but that was, sorry to interrupt. That was a brilliant.
And sorry to discuss.
What was your favorite thing there?
We kind of ordered, we went through and ordered everything.
Yep.
I would say
if you have enough people, that's the move at that place because everything is so interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the menu is small.
Yeah, yeah, there's not a lot to dig through.
Unlike real us talking about food shit. Kimchi with the like pineapple jus kimchi. Shit like that I thought was my favorite stuff. Like the bowls are insane and they're amazing, but I was way more excited by eating the pickles because I was
I really like that
white pineapple kimchi where you're like, that still looks like Napa cabbage. Yeah. And it's not. It's like fizzy. It's got that fermentation and the pineapple jus just kills it.
They don't call it banchan, but I feel like I mean, that's what it is to me. But it's like,
that's because they charge for it.
Right. Yeah. You should be able just to order like, just can I have that and a side of rice? Yeah. Like and those large drinks. Servings and a side of rice.
Those drinks were crazy. Like I've never really had, because everyone that I was with were just like, oh, these are like those sipping vinegars.
Oh, yeah.
I've never had that before.
Yeah,
what do they call those again?
I don't know what they call them because...
Beyond shrubs, I take it?
I don't know what they call them because they're Korean.
They have a special name for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they have kombucha and then they have another one. I forgot what it's called.
Yeah, that's way more vinegary, but it was like an elderflower one or a pineapple one, same.
It's interesting to me because it's only two people that do it front to back.
They're called the tepache.
Yes.
Tepache?
Which is a Mexican thing, right?
I guess so, yeah.
You would think that, I mean, or everybody thought that they would be out of business in like 3 months. Like this was like almost like an art installation, them trying to do this, just the two of them and the quality of what they're making and for the money they're charging. They're still open. It's been, 2 years? Year and a half?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's amazing to me that it's still happening and it makes me very happy.
Still the same guys. And arguably, I saw that they went over to New York to do a little pop-up at Wild Air.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not into Wild Air, even though I know a lot of people are, so apologies, but I literally got up from a meal and left and went over to Estella to finish my meal at what? Because I didn't think what else.
I like it.
But
I like pulling no punches.
Yeah, but I like that they went out and they could, you know, we're talking about this with other friends, but the idea that there's two of them, so they can close shop and they're in what? Little Armenia or whatever that area is called, where they can close shop for a month,
go to New York. Destroyed on rent, in theory.
Do a business there and then still come back.
Yeah,
like that's just.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure their rent is like $1,200 or something.
I don't. I mean, yeah. I would. All I know is that it's cheaper than being on La Brea.
Yeah,
but then local is on La Brea today.
Yeah,
which again I think is a super interesting idea of like how something that can be fucking super tasty and still have $2 meal deals.
Yeah. Well, it's a different La Brea than what I'm talking about.
Cheap coffee.
Of course.
It's a little bit of a deeper La Brea.
Different part of La Brea.
Well, yeah, the truck now.
Yeah, that's what I kind of mean.
Exactly. Oh, they have a truck now.
Yeah, they have a truck. That's what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the truck. Because they pulled out outside of Undefeated today.
Yeah, they're all over the place. And they've been around all over LA. Yeah.
Got to follow along on the gram. Tay. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, guys. I've been, it's an honor.
What's your Instagram so people can go find you?
An honor. Thank you.
My Instagram is kind of redundant.
It's your name.
No, it's at TFC Bootleg. But I don't update it. I only got those stories, so you can only see what's real.
Okay.
Real life.
Fire.
Is there somewhere online that people should go to see you?
No.
Okay.
No, they can. You
Man
can,
of mystery.
We do. Yeah, let's keep it like that
TFC
way.
TFC Bootleg on Instagram, or you can just follow me instead.
Exactly. Way sexier.
Stewie Stewart on Instagram, Undercut Empire on social media.
Don't hit it.
TheStewPodcast.com is the website where all the episodes live. Please take a brief moment to go on iTunes and subscribe. Give us a nice little rating and review so we can get bumped up and juicier.
That'd be good.
Quick one on that.
Food Festival?
Quick one on that, though. Why aren't you on SoundCloud?
No, I just don't like SoundCloud.
All right, that's good.
SoundCloud's just kind of whack. And then they're going to be bought by Spotify.
They have their issues.
Yeah, I heard that on.
I have a personal. Just
lots of people do lately.
I'm not into it.
Yeah,
you know they've canceled half the people I know has their SoundCloud accounts canceled, deleted, 100%. Removed, suspended. It's just like
we get calls from our own music we own.
Yeah, yeah. The record label that you work at, I'm sure every week you get a message saying the song that you have paid to produce and record and mix and master and release is being taken down by your own record label for copyright infringement.
And the best way that happens is when you're about to release it on announced day and you've all planned and beautifully orchestrated rollout strategy to launch at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
and it's been pulled down.
Mm-hmm. So I prefer...
So we're good.
Just straight away iTunes. That's where most people... The majority of the world listens to their podcasts.
No, that's good. It was literally
just a quick, very crush.
valid little cue,
mm-hmm.
little Q&A.
So that's what it is, and that's where podcasting lives. Mm. And then I will be tomorrow. If you're listening to this Saturday, or if you're listening to it Sunday, it is today at the Eastside Food Festival in Silver Lake, California. You can go to eastsidefoodfest.com.
To make it easier, that's Sunday, October 2nd.
You can also say October 2nd
in, there you go.
In Los Angeles.
The 2nd of October.
Or the 2nd of October. A bunch of food vendors from all over L.A., especially the east side, but a little bit of everything.
A lot of the ones that we like very much have talked about before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Sticky Rice, Silver Lake Wine, Same Same, Twa Familia, Pock Pock, Ohana Poke, Momed, Little Beast, Kitchen Mouse, Kettle Black, Jolly Oyster, Jenny's Ice Cream, Go Get Him Tiger, Homestead.
Shout out to Poke's PR firm. Mm.
Yeah.
Just Poke in general is going to be there. Boxed Water, The Big Green Egg, Button Mash, Angel City, Better Booch, Clover. It's all there. And the list goes on. But also, I will be hosting the kind of panel discussion area. Alvin from Egg Slut, his podcast with the Bad Mash guys, are going to record one of those. They're going to record an episode of Snacky Tunes, a podcast from... Food podcast from New York, and then
Greg and Darren.
Yeah, Greg and Darren.
Tying it back to what we were saying at the beginning, they're the ones who did dinner with the band.
Yeah,
the ones who won.
Screw you guys. And then there's going to be a seminar on edibles, marijuana, and cooking.
No,
and then another one about kind of living waste-free and reducing your carbon footprint and all that stuff. But the majority of what happens is you walk around, eat a bunch of food.
For a great price.
Have some alcohol.
Goes to charity, a lot of it.
Bunch of cool people, most of it goes to a nonprofit charity. And it's a cool thing, and our friends do it. So come through and check that out if you are available.
Oh, yeah, Monday as well. One more. I know they don't employ me anymore, but Otium and Burger Lords are doing a collab on Monday and every Monday of October. After party at General Lee's, like roasted eel on a burger. Like, interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it should be really good.
I'm definitely gonna be there.
See you Monday.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, guys.
Bye.